Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you another Art Monthly talk show. I am joined today by two writers from the September issue 489 of Art Monthly. The first we're going to start with, at least, is Lillian Wilkie's piece, which is we called Letter from Barnsley, Civic Pride. Hello, Lillian.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And we're joined also by Dave Beach, who has been on the programme quite a few times before. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
And Dave's written a feature which is about fundamentally working class, the area of working class, but it's following on, which I would really recommend the readers to your listeners, sorry, to do is read a piece also by Morgan Quaintance, which appeared in the June issue. I think it's fair to say, Dave, it's probably a supporting feature and to bring the subject. Well, keep it alive, keep it going. Is
Yeah,
that
exactly.
right?
I say that it's written in solidarity and to keep the ball rolling.
Yeah.
So, effectively saying having one article about class in art is probably not the end of the matter.
No. Okay. And as I'm sure we have discussed class previously in the magazine, that's for sure, and probably on this program at some point in various forms. The program with Morgan, there is a program with Morgan as well. So there's a feature in the magazine, June issue, and there's a program with Chris McCormack discussing that with Morgan, which I recommend highly too. And then we're having a bash at talking together here. And we're gonna, but we'll, let's start talking about Barnsley. That's what we should do. So, Lillian, why Barnsley?
So I run, well, co-run Art Book Fair in Manchester, which is where I'm originally from. And the book fair is called Bound Art Book Fair. I'll give it a quick plug. It's going to be this October on the 25th and 26th at the Whitworth Art Gallery in Manchester. The book fair was really set up to provide opportunities for artists, publishers, DIY bookmakers, zinesters to share their work without having to travel to London. And it's been going for 7 or 8 years now, I think, and there's been a really fascinating community of publishers, artists, photographers who have kind of coalesced around Bound. And it's been an amazing way to meet and to support artists. And over the last few years, I just started to meet a lot of artists from Barnsley. Barnsley is somewhere that I'd never visited before. I would often travel over to South Yorkshire or to places like Wakefield to visit the Hepworth or Yorkshire Sculpture Park, but I hadn't been to Barnsley. But through Bound, I met first Jake, Rob, and Spencer, who I mentioned in the article, who are part of the Borough Collective, who are photographers, bookmakers, zinesters, making really, really interesting work. And then the artist Sam Batley, who I really kind of base this piece around. And I felt then, especially in at Bound Art Book Fair 2024, that there seemed to be like something happening. And I was really keen to find out more about it. I live very deep south now, so I lived in London for many, many years, and now I live in a town called St Leonards, which is right on the Sussex coast. But I
It's next to
try as
Hastings, isn't it?
it's next to Hastings.
There's a
It's
lot
very
of
lovely.
artists live there, though, aren't there?
Lots of artists live there. It's a great place for photography, for independent publishing. I love it. It's a beautiful day here as well. But I have always tried to maintain those links with sort of these micro communities in the north, who I think are producing really quite incredible work against the odds. Sam produced this fantastic film called The Town I Love So Well, and it was being premiered at the Parkway Cinema back in April. And I just thought, well, this is a great opportunity to go to Barnsley to see the Borough Boys in their studio, do some of the studio visits. And see the film. And I'd long kind of followed the Art Monthly letter from column. And, you know, it's always like letter from Bogota or letter from, you know, Brasilia or letter from Kampala.
Letter from Barnes has got a far better ring, hasn't it?
And I thought, why not do a letter from Barnsley? Because I think if we're honest, Barnsley might as well be Kampala
Yeah.
to a lot of the, especially London-centric cultural community. And I thought that a dispatch from there would not only be enriching for me, but also, really important for Art Monthly readers, wherever they are. So that's why Barnsley.
Thank you for answering the question. It's great. Well, but please, can you describe the film, which
yes.
is The Town I Love So Well by Sam Butler.
Yeah.
Batley, sorry. What's in it? I mean, is it? Would you call it an art film, or is that an irrelevant term? It has lots of different people in it, I think.
It does. Yeah, it's that flavour of documentary filmmaking which is made by artists and has a specific pace, a comfort with space. An oddness, which I think his artistic sensibility, you know, brings into it. So it's not a straightforward classic piece of documentary filmmaking, like I've said in the piece. It's got a lot of humour whilst not being kind of sort of jocular in any way.
How does that come out of? Is it the way he asks questions or of people or the what the? I was interested in that humour idea because it's
yeah. I mean, Sam doesn't really appear as a kind of interlocutor in the film. He's very much lets people speak for themselves. I guess it first of all comes across in the people and the places that he has selected to appear in this film. A lot of the characters just have an incredibly, you know, people like Ian McMillan and others who are specifically are related to the All Grief Peace and Justice, All Grief Truth and Justice campaign, I should say. They're just funny people. I don't know. There's just that great sense of informality, warmth, not taking themselves too seriously. And I think that that's something that the film seems to hold simultaneously. It's this sense of, as I've said, deep poetry and indeed beauty and the sheer creativity of a lot of these communities and taking that really seriously and looking at that with care and criticality, but also this is a community people don't take themselves too seriously. It's not over professionalized, it's not sound bites, and I think that's something that perhaps you could argue that working class practices are able to kind of contain, and that's where some of that humor comes out. You know, nobody is trying to over intellectualize or academicize what they're doing. It's very felt in a very human way.
So, I mean, for instance, Craig Oldham,
yes,
you mentioned, and he says, "I love I can't even say it,
Fluoro,
Fluoro," which I Googled, and it came up as a design company in London.
So, what I think what he means there is, if you imagine in, I hope you can imagine, but in a lot of the markets around where I grew up, at least, I'm thinking about the original like covered markets, you'd get these, it's signage really. It's shop signage using kind of fluorescent colours, perhaps stars, slogans. That's really what he means, that the vibrance of the colours.
A bit like Bob and Roberta Smith signs, would
yeah,
that,
kind
would
of, but like not twee. This is like,
oh, right, it's twee. Good.
No, sorry, I'm.
Well, you can have an opinion; it's allowed.
No,
so that's
on.
Interesting. But it's actually interesting because you're talking about aesthetics in a way, aren't you? You're talking
absolutely,
about
yeah,
a form, which is, your, is it a Barnsley form, do you think? It's not, is it? It's more kind
I
of.
I don't think Craig is necessarily suggesting that Barnsley has a specific aesthetic, but I think what he's speaking to is the sensual quality of those kinds of spaces, the call and response of the traditional sort of covered market, the grocery market, the chat, the gossip, the kind of musicality of a lot of people's voices, being surrounded by sights and smells and signs trying to grab your attention. That kind of, multi-sensory is life, isn't it? It's the vibrance of life. And I think what Craig was trying to say is that he really sees how that has fed into the way that he thinks about communication now. And he's working across contexts, across publication design, across branding. But the way he li it continues to live and breathe in the way that he thinks about visual culture. But I keep on going back to this idea of the sensorial and the sensual. It's really present in places like that, and that doesn't leave you.
He's got his book In Loving Memory of Work,
Amazing book. Yeah, everyone should see this book.
which is a visual record of the strike and
Of
the
the
miners'
miners'
strike,
strike. Yeah.
and an exploration of the ways in which those involved design and produce their own visual material.
That's it.
So it's a sort of analytical book in a way.
It is, but it's a deeply visual book. It's a large format book. It's not academic text, although it does include a lot of testimony and writing, interpretive writing. But it's a really, I mean, I know that we're on radio here because I'm tempted to get it out and show you. But it's a really fantastic, as it says, a visual record of the types of incredible graphic design, visual material, flyers, ephemera, signage, banners,
A collection of stuff by other people.
that have come out of movements such as the miners' strike. But Craig's dad was a miner. He comes from a long line of miners, and his dad was, I believe, his dad was arrested at Orgreave. His family were deeply involved in the strike and the cultures that emerged around it, because of course you've not just got striking miners, you've got the miners' wives who are producing, soup kitchens and keeping people fed. You've got collectives who are coming together, mutual aid groups who are producing and really amazing banners, protest signage. And Craig really wanted to pay tribute to those skills and the success of a lot of that material, even though the strike ultimately would not be considered a success, but the ways in which communities came together to produce that material. So he was able to sort of tap into his networks through his family. I think he talks about like asking his dad to go down the pub and ask people whether they've still got stuff that, some of this stuff in their drawers at home, and bring it together, scan it, and appreciate it
Yeah,
and
so otherwise
show.
it's a lost archive, as
Absolutely.
in lost, not in one place, whereas so the book helps to bring things together. It's the third edition by, and it's published by Rough Trade, I believe.
Yeah, so the current edition is published by Rough Trade. The first two editions were published under Craig's own imprint. But yeah, absolutely. As you say, this stuff becomes incredibly dispersed, and bringing it together allows for a different type of recognition and interpretation, and indeed to inform contemporary communities of protest.
But interestingly, it's not a museum display. It's not hidden away in a museum archive either, is it? It's
It's not.
presented in
Arguably,
a much more street form. That means it's a which seems very suitable to me.
totally. I mean, the book form allows it to be fugitive and allows it to move across various contexts and places. It's a little bit more accessible. And Craig's just a, I don't, I kind of want to swear when I talk about Craig in a positive way. He's just such an amazing designer and person. And so the book is also a natural medium for him.
Let's name some other people, because you mentioned younger artists working in Barnsley
Yes.
and who also feature in the film, multidisciplinary Elia
Eilish.
Piano
Trainer, yeah.
and a fibre artist, which I have to confess I don't know what that is, Eloise Clarkson. But interesting.
Eloise, she spins her own yarns, dyes and spins her own yarn. So there's an element of the kind of craft and almost like fashion and garment
And that
production
doesn't
to her
mean she makes up her
practice.
own stories, does it?
Well, I mean, she would. She, you might say that she tells stories through her medium, but she also has produced works as sort of like, I can't really call them two-dimensional because they have a real sort of tactility. But she's produced works that incorporate texts. So she's like weaving and knitting texts, which in one of the shows I saw at the Barnsley Civic, these texts which utilize a lot of local dialect, were then combined with Sam Batley and Sean O'Connell's photographs. So she works, it's very sort of cross-disciplinary and cross-contextual.
You also say she acknowledges the teaching, the tutelage, I think the word, of their grandmothers, both Triana and Clarkson.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably something that, you know, Dave can reflect on. And certainly it's something that there's a great writer called Jennifer Jasmine White, who does a lot of research into female working class creativity. But I guess one of the arguments that I was trying to tease out, and to be honest, I could have written like thousands and thousands of words on Barnsley and the people that I met there. And I'm pretty rubbish at meeting word counts anyway. But
well, hopefully you will write again.
Maybe. But I guess what I'm sort of trying to suggest is that there is a long-standing creative practice amongst many working class communities, which is not necessarily always recognized as an art practice, certainly not recognized in any kind of professionalized sense, and that many of these people engaged in creative practices on a day-to-day basis would not even feel comfortable considering themselves as artists, because that could sometimes be considered somehow sort of like highfalutin or pretentious.
You talk about imposter syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there is this sense in which creative problem solving is a key part of working class life, and specifically the working class childhood, which we talked about in relation to Craig Oldham. Tinkering, making, because you've not really got the resources to buy. And there are really fascinating ways in which that then feeds into the kind of enshrinement of a more formal creative practice. But then you can also think about the ways in which music and song, and, you know, keep on going back to this issue of poetry, that they're so present within these communities, especially within industrial communities. And I think, you know, we talked earlier about how you might kind of rationalize or define this idea of the working class. But maybe in this context, I'm really thinking about communities bonded by industry and industrial activism, and the spaces of solidarity and community that form around those places. The pubs that would have specific rooms for dirty men, you know, who'd come out of the mines, you know, and the cultures that develop in those spaces, the music, the song that comes out of those. I am excited to consider the ways in which those practices come into what we now are sort of talking about as like a contemporary art space, and how they start to come into the institution, and they start to inform work which perhaps doesn't have a necessarily overly conscious class consciousness, an overly kind of self-identifying class consciousness, but yet those cultures are inherent and are more felt than understood.
You mentioned Ian McMillan, who's a subscriber to Art Monthly, I believe.
Oh, fantastic. Well, hello, Ian, if you're listening. Yeah, real legend, actually.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, I hear him on Radio 4.
Yeah. I mean, and like I say in the piece, an amazing advocate for not just culture in Yorkshire culture, but also dialect, and you know, he's the ways in which he has managed to really enter the institution, you know, those big state institutions, but also retain those links to where he's from. And I just want to quote him, because I quote him in the piece where he says, because he's lived in Darfield, which is one of the pit villages that make up the broader borough of Barnsley. He's always lived there. And he says, when I'm not here, I feel diminished. I feel like I've got fewer dimensions. I feel like a cardboard cutout of myself. And I just thought that was one of the most incredibly beautiful and stirring ways to think about a connection with place. And how amazing
Well, I
is
mean, I
that?
think when people move away from their origin, as it were, their childhood origin and their family's origin, they never forget where they come from. And I know lots of people who do not live where they like in they don't live in Barnsley, but they come from Barnsley. They don't live in Oldham, they come from Oldham, wherever it may be, or they don't live in Kent. I mean, it doesn't matter. You don't forget it. In a sense, and especially I would say if your culture is very strong
Well, that's
in a
it. I mean, I
collaborative,
don't.
unified culture, like which I didn't have, the suburbs of London, you don't
Yeah.
have that. But
Well,
it
that's it. I
sounds
mean,
like they got a much better life to me in that sense.
carry South Manchester in me to a certain extent, even though I've not lived there for nearly 20 years. But I'd never say that when I'm not there, I feel diminished. You know, I think that that's something that's really
It's a bit
extraordinary
more powerful, isn't it?
and powerful, exactly. And I think it really speaks to the complexities. And also what I argue in the piece is that even though a lot of the artists who I spoke to and spent time with in Barnsley and continue to speak to and spend time with are too young to remember them, weren't born during the miners' strike. In fact, hardly anybody I spoke to was born during the miners' strike. Craig Oldham is considered a strike bairn because he was conceived during the miners' strike. But I think what I sort of tried to argue is that legacy, generational legacy of labour activism and solidarity and an understanding of socialist principles, carries forth. And is sort of understood implicitly by a lot of those artists who perhaps have never been on strike and have never been a part of a union. But the culture is so deep there and is so, yeah, I think generationally inherited, as is the trauma of those experiences. I think if you have a father or a grandfather or an uncle who was brutalized at Orgreave, and then you've got to live and grow up in a culture that diminishes that and undermines that. And it's only recently, and it's still an ongoing campaign to achieve justice for those men and women. But that is, it's something which can obviously be deeply troubling, but it's so profound. And how exciting to channel that into the production of artwork. And I think that, you know, I guess another conclusion as to why I felt that it was really important to write about and to draw attention to what's happening in places like Barnsley.
Well done. Thank you so much. But let's link to Dave. I don't want to preempt how Dave would like to sort of begin talking about his feature in relation to what you've just said, but I'm sure you will. Dave, how would you like to start your.
Well, that was great, Lillian. It's there's more overlap than it might first appear because my conception of class, because I come from a northern town, is initially place-based. I Warrington was a working class town, literally a working class town insofar as the middle class didn't live in it. They lived outside of it in the countryside in Cheshire and places like that. And so it was dominated not only by working class bodies, but working class values, working class institutions. And so in a way, there's this ongoing debate when people talk about class politics. About the relationship between, or the advantages and disadvantages of workplace disputes versus other kinds of disputes, and I think coming from the north of England, there really wasn't any sense of this distinction between workplace issues and community issues because community issues were built in. to everything that was going on. Everything was bled through, you know, so in both directions. So workplace issues are community issues. They're issues in the family. They're in the streets. They're in the pubs. And vice versa, that the workplace becomes a kind of concentration of those shared experiences in the streets and in the pubs and in other places. And so, you know, that there's this a brilliant book by Jane McAlevey called No Shortcuts. And she's arguing for politics to kind of recombine the workplace with social issues. Because she says that the real kind of momentum and longevity of political debates is not in the workplace, but is in the community. And the workplace is a great concentration. It's a great place for these issues to come out. But if you, in a sense, put all your eggs in that basket, then as soon as the workplace breaks up, or as soon as work is farmed out to somewhere else, then you've lost your politics. It needs to be in the community. And it's interesting. And you know, she's dealing with certain places in the USA, and where the politics is maybe more about kind of political organizing in a kind of mobilizing kind of sense. In other words, it's a kind of administrative thing, and it's based on in workplaces. But that wasn't my experience of politics growing up. There was this real meshing of the social and the workplace of these two aspects being one, rather than us feeling the need to put one inside the other.
But Dave, what about that? That was what, obviously, your experience as a younger person. Now, for instance, in Barnsley, you put in your piece, Lillian, that 40,000 residents deemed economically inactive. So this idea of work, it just made me think, well, okay, well, where is work now, and where are we at?
Maybe, well, the point that I was making, Matt, is that we shouldn't overestimate the importance of the work or the workplace.
Okay.
Because the locus of those traditions of revolt and protest and rebellion are in the community. And what Lillian was talking about earlier was that these traditions are still alive.
Yeah, sure.
Outside of the workplace.
Yeah, I was going to say, it has to be outside of the workplace more now, doesn't it? That's all I was thinking.
Yeah, and so, you know, and they can, you can transfer them to other places, like the school, you know, so, or the university, or to other institutions where there's a concentration of this community, you know, so that even though the workplace is still a massive politicizing place, it's not the only place for us to think about where these confrontations and also confrontations with others, but also the solidarity amongst yourself can take place.
I just got to say this quote. Bruce McLean, I saw him say it very recently, and he's got a show in the Scottish National Gallery, and he says, he's being interviewed, and he keeps saying, oh, that's a word I can't use, that's a word you can't use. And one of the words he says is, he doesn't like the word education. He likes learning together, which I thought was a really interesting distinction, because he didn't really go into it at all, but he just said something like, because I don't like being told what to think. I know it's a very crude sort of definition of what education is, because education can be incredibly liberal and very learning together, can't it? But you do mean the learning together aspect of it, I imagine.
Well, not necessarily. Or maybe something much more fundamental than Bruce is thinking of there. He's thinking of a style of learning. Whereas, you know, when I talk about education in my article, and I refer to Linda Morris in the first ever issue of Art Monthly talking about working class people going to university to study art, and that being potentially, you know, at this point in 1976, you know, you're projecting forward thinking this is going to transform what art is, because there's going to be more and more working class people involved in art. And then, you know, not thinking fully, I mean, not understanding at that point, and maybe not understanding for several decades after that, that there's a massive difference between a working class person going to university and a middle class person going to university. The middle class person enters more fully, more deeply into their class by going to university. The working class person is cut off from their community by going to university. And you lose your resources. You lose your collective resources. You lose that kind of, you know, that power that we were talking about. You, in a sense, you know, if it's true that leaving Barnsley diminishes you, then this is true of every working class person going to university. They're diminished by going there. Even though they gain other things, there is a kind of cultural, normative diminishment of who you are by going there.
It's sort of flattening off of culture, in a sense. Oh, I don't mean, well, I mean, you know, like everywhere, like you're sort of everywhere but nowhere.
Well, we talked earlier. You mentioned to Lillian earlier on about that that imposter syndrome, that feeling, which the concept of imposter syndrome implies that it's your fault. You're the one who feels the imposter syndrome. But actually, what happens to a lot of working class people when they go to university is that they're literally told by people, "You don't belong here." You know, and you can be told that because of, like, you know, like the first ever teaching job I got. I was teaching art history at the Slade, and a woman said to a friend of mine, "He's got the wrong accent to teach art history." And then, but you also got people like taking to one side, and it's like, because, you know, I'm working class and I'm Northern and all the things that go with that. I was told in my first year at university that I should be like less enthusiastic. You know, you've got to be cooler than that. And, you know, I should maybe like take things more slowly, and just basically told to that my behavior was just not appropriate for university. But this was behavior that was applauded back, you know, in my working class community. So you're kind of bit by bit, you have to like shave off aspects of your culture in order to become fully part of this culture that you've entered into. So these are real things,
yeah,
and they're imposed on you. So it feels wrong to me to call it imposter syndrome, because it's not your syndrome. Well, let's start by saying that there are, a spectrum of ways in which the working class operate within middle class culture. And I'm not here to criticise any of the ways that people cope with being an alien.
No, you do say that in your feature, I know.
So, you know, some people pass, you know. Maria Fusco, who's also got a fantastic piece in this issue of Art Monthly, writes in her book, I think it's in the preface or something, introduction or something like that, that she always found it easy to pass as middle class. And when I read that, I thought, oh my God, I've never found it easy to pass. But you know that some people do. But the strange thing from my point of view of always being called out for being working class is I felt like I wanted to know that the people that pass as middle class were actually working class. I would have felt better if I'd have known that they were working class. It would have helped me, I think, you know, looking back on it. But anyway, but passing is one way of dealing with this, and that's absolutely fine, you know. And the it's not like you're a traitor if you pass. I wouldn't argue that. It's one way of doing this. And then other people, you know, like someone asked me the other day, you know, what happened when you first went to art school, and I said, well, you know, I before going to art school, I'd already become an indie fan, so I was already dressed indie, so I didn't look like my working class friends. I looked like a student, because I dressed like a student because I was into indie music. And then when I went to college, in my first, whatever, like couple of weeks there, I realized all the middle class kids looked more working class than I did because they were all dressing down. And I thought, I can't have this. So like, you know, when my grant cleared, because that was back in the day when we got grants, I went to the Army and Navy store and I bought a donkey jacket. I'd never worn one at home. I bought this for college.
To assert, insert his class. You know
what I mean? It was such a bizarre thing to do. But it felt like, how do I assert that I'm actually working class when everyone else is dressing down and pretending to be working class?
But I've certainly known people who've really worked hard to drop their accent, which is
lots of other things as well. It's not just the
accent. That's just an example I can see or hear.
Yeah, it's things like lowering the volume of your voice. Learning that that's something you should do, and then then actually implementing that, and I don't know, like, maybe not all working class households are like my working class household, but where I come from, people speak over each other all the time. The conversation gets louder and louder and louder because more and more people are talking at the same time. And I just thought that was normal. And then when I went to college, I had to, you know, people would look at me like, that's wrong. And I had to learn to, like, stop, let someone else say something, and then wait for your turn to add something. And all of that was very foreign to me because we would just chip in.
You know, I'm a bit like that on Zoom. I've had to learn to not chip in on Zoom because it's a bit, it just ends up being nothing really, which is a bit odd. Okay, so there's a little, not an elephant in the room, but there's an area which I would think we probably would be quite good to try to discuss, but I might be wrong and I won't put the question right. I'm hesitant on this, but fundamentally, we're talking about class, where there's been a lot of conversation going on around other areas of people's identities and their perhaps economics situations, but and sexuality. These areas have been really massive in the art world in the last 10 years, perhaps more. They were always around, but what they seem to have done, and I did genuinely was feeling this quite a lot lately, of they've suppressed the conversation on class because, you know, poverty and class are common to many people, whatever their race, sexuality. And I personally am really pleased that there might be something, if a conversation like this can grow more, some of those very specific things, not that they're not important, but they might come together and unify. I mean, there's a sort of unification. I feel as if we've been fractured. But, I mean, does this make any sense? Does that... I don't know. I think I'm wondering whether Morgan, that's really where Morgan might... But I didn't really want to discuss Morgan's piece without him being here. But that area of conversation and being suppressing the one on working class or on class...
I mean, I thought that it was interesting in Morgan's piece. You know, he used this example of the exhibition at Two Temple Place, which was called Lives Less Ordinary. And he spoke very favourably. I mean, it was an incredible work in that show. Maybe I feel instinctively uncomfortable somehow with this idea of almost siloing or using class status, self-identified or otherwise, as a specific reason to bring a very, very diverse group of artists together. Most of those artists did consider their experiences of class as part of their practice, not always explicitly. But there seems to have been this thing in the last couple of years, you know, that show, there was also Johnny Pitts curated a Hayward touring exhibition called After the End of History, which looked at British working class photography. I think that it's great that we're having these conversations, obviously, and I really sort of appreciated, Dave, the way you spoke about, you introduced your piece as being as in solidarity with Morgan's piece, and part of what you hope was an ongoing conversation to start to bring to the surface and really kind of elucidate on some of these concepts. I think that maybe part of the issue that we have in terms of those exhibitions is that, yes, whilst we should be acknowledging the complexities, the ambivalences, and the beauty and the poetry of class experience, whilst that exists within a structural material reality of an art world which is essentially out of reach. I say the art world, I mean, maybe it's a whole other conversation to define what we mean by the art world. But whilst university remains almost absurdly, not almost, absolutely absurdly expensive and sometimes structurally harmful to a lot of people from marginalized backgrounds, whilst simply having a studio, being able to rent a studio, to have space to make your work, to be able to juggle an art practice alongside sometimes multiple forms of precarious labor, whilst all those things exist, yeah, there's something about bringing working class status as a kind of curatorial device that just feels a bit uncomfortable. I want to see working class artists represented in every group exhibition, and not have their class status necessarily be the reason why they're brought together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to the situation of, certain black artists, for instance, would not want to be included in an exhibition like Rashida Rehn's Other Story because they didn't want to be included because of their race rather than because of the quality of their work or something like that. And you get other and certain women didn't want to be included as a woman artist, but just as an artist, and so that's kind of always gone along with these things. I guess what one of the reasons why I would want to be included in an exhibition of working class artists and would not want to be kind of set the condition that I only want to be included as an artist, not as a working class artist, is because I think that these are really important, milestones in that kind of recognition, just at some point, just like simply as, oh, I didn't realize there were so many of them,
Right. Yeah.
silly things like that, or if you did have, I mean, you wouldn't have that kind of issue with an exhibition of black artists or an exhibition of women artists. What you would get with an exhibition of working class artists is that thing, I didn't know she was working class. Do you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
I hear you.
And so the invisibility of it makes the exhibition of it kind of more of an issue, I think.
Yeah.
So that we've got two questions really. How did it come about that class was excluded from this kind of from the university and the art world in terms of its sense of what are the struggles, what are the emancipations that are necessary right now? How did class get excluded from that? But also, if you've had decades of the working class not being organized within art and not being written about, not being identified, not being thought about, not being considered, then where do we start now? And one of the things that is very clear today is that there is this like mushrooming of working class organizations, working class artists, working class galleries, working class support groups, and so on and so on, right? Because
naming themselves as such, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a really kind of mushrooming thing. And it's like it's got real momentum to it. And there's a real kind of working class, very sort of... It's a very ground up kind of thing. And what's happening is that this gives us a feeling like this is what I think is like the clear thing in Morgan's piece. It gives us a feeling that there's this new chapter being written. There's this new phase coming up, that the working class in art is present in a way that it's not been present for decades. And so one of the things that I wanted to add to that is and not in any way to diminish that, but to add that after decades of neglect, this doesn't mean, this mushrooming doesn't mean that we are in a really strong position right now. We are starting from nothing or less than nothing. There is no adequate theory of class right now. There are no traditions. There are no movements. There's all the things that we would have previously turned to as our resources have gone. So we've got lots of like little kind of almost like family sized organizations that are, and individuals, you know, like Morgan and like Maria Fusco, who are making a noise about this, but that we're all working in this kind of in very unpromising conditions. Mm. And so what I wanted to do is say the theory of class that we're using within these organizations of class is marked by these decades of neglect, because in a sense this is me just echoing what you just said, Matt, that it's not just that more people have been talking about race, gender, sexuality and so forth. These discourses have been getting better and richer and stronger and more thoughtful and more discriminating and cleverer and more, just like everything about those discourses has become compelling. And so when we then say, what about class? It's like we're going back in time and we're saying, oh, that thing we thought about in the 70s. Well, those 70s ideas are terrible. And it's like, but we're not living in the 70s, but we haven't been adding to the theory in a way that makes the theory of class as compelling as a theory of race, gender, and sexuality.
So is that what you're trying to do now, Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we all need to do, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
No, I think the internet also provides remarkable opportunities for that. And I just was reflecting earlier when we were talking about the ways in which the sort of traditional industrial bases, the decline of the traditional industrial bases and that sense of labour activism being present and felt but not actually experienced. I think just to jump back to the conversation that we're having now, that intersectionality, the ways in which actually internet discourses have provided space to consider intersectionality between class and race, class and sexuality, class and gender. Looking to people like, is he called Chris Smalls? He led a lot of the Amazon workplace strikes in the United States, and he became his labor organizer there, an amazing media performer, as well as being, a really fantastic activist. Recently joined a flotilla to try to bring aid into Gaza. And I think those kinds of actions, those kinds of narratives, we're starting to see hopeful shoots of connecting the dots between issues around colonialism, issues around empire, issues around class, and issues around race specifically in that. I mean, they're all tied up only really in that one example. But yeah, I mean, I think I feel, despite Dave, you're absolutely right, But I also feel this sort of potential for some optimism. Morgan mentioned some of those organizations like Working Class Creatives Database, stuff like that, the White Pube, pulling together funding application library so that people can access successful funding applications. You know, we're starting to see what could be called a kind of labor solidarity. It's, we do also see artists unions emerging, Artists Union England being one of them, who have then worked in tandem with organizations like We Industria to challenge genocidal links to between funders for places like the Tate. So I think that there's reasons for tentative excitement and optimism in the ways in which class is understood and performed and utilized within the art world. Obviously, there's so much more to be done, as Dave points out, after those decades, generations of neglect.
I suppose I'm thinking of a kind of, they are all perfectly laudable, and I don't mean that to sound patronizing, but it probably does, different energies of great importance. And it's like almost like a kind of a sense, a sort of desire to bring them together. And it's that, because that's where real power will lie, is in an understanding that they are all people together, that they're not separate factions. And in the way that Dave described, everyone being in little villages, as it were, around Britain, this and that. And I'm thinking of independent art schools. Some of those are coming out of working class situations, I think. And it's how do you get them all to recognize each other on an equal and respectful level? I'm not saying they don't, but it's a desire.
But it's
Because
a story of the
we're
British
about half.
left, isn't it, though? Like, I mean,
Say again.
it's the story of the British left. Like, how do you
No,
get them
sure.
to,
Because
like,
if you're not careful, it'll just go
coalesce?
back into that again, won't it?
I
Fractionism
don't.
and fighting and all. Is that what you mean?
Well, I don't see factionalism and fighting across the working class art community at the moment.
Good, no. Good, good.
But yes, there's this age-old question as to how to bring all of these different concerns and methodologies into chorus.
Dave, is that what you are thinking about as well? Or am I oversimplifying it, I imagine.
Well, I don't think that we need another organisation under which all of these organisations exist or anything like
No.
that.
No.
And I don't think that all of these organisations should, I don't know, join the TUC or something. You know what I mean? I don't think that that's the model we're looking for. But I think that when we survey, so I'm thinking more of like, someone writing for Art Monthly, when you notice that these things are happening, it's also a kind of it's a reminder that the theory needs to catch up too. And the organizations are, so long as they remain fragmented in this way, then they're not as strong as those emancipatory struggles which have national organizations, multiple national organizations in some cases. So the shoots of a recovery have to be understood as exactly what they are. This does not amount to a kind of a new powerhouse in arts organizations. It's far from it. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, yes, this is brilliant, but look how small it is, and look how weak it is, and look how I don't know that it's fresh and it's beautiful and it gives you hope, but we need to cultivate something other than just having lots of these little organizations. And part of that is about discourse. It's about how we understand what's happening, how we theorize what's happening, how we connect what's happening here to what's happening there. And and so that there needs to be, as I said with at the beginning of my piece, in relation to Morgan, that we need to keep the ball rolling. because the talking is also part of what brings us all together. I mean, one of the things from my own perspective that has come out of all of this is noticing that these other people exist by the fact that they've put these things together when they would have, you know, and so long as all of these other working class workers in art are invisible to you, you feel alone. And yes, you feel like, you know, well, I'm not going to mention that because it's just me. And then you keep quiet in meetings and in other kind of situations and even in seminars and things like that. You say, I'll not raise the class thing because I'm the only person here that's interested in that. So you don't mention it. And so the more people that kind of pop their heads up and say, you know, I'm in a working class organization as well, the more you kind of recognize that it is wider than just yourself. But also the style of what they're doing is very new. You know, so working class, like self-help groups, you know, like support groups where you can get advice and you can get, you know, and you can share experiences. That's one of the main things that's come up here. Just share your experiences. You know, here are people that want to hear what you've got to say about your experiences. And when I first came across that, I thought, you know, I've never told anyone about my experiences before. And I don't even know what they are because I've never reflected on them. So I started just making notes on, like, so what has my experience in art been like from a working class perspective? And weirdly, you know, a student of mine asked me if I would speak on a podcast he was organizing about working class people. And I said, I can't. I've got nothing to say because, you know, I've only done theory. I've never really, I've got,
sorry, I shouldn't
to say
laugh, but it is a bit...
And then after that, I just kind of thought, well, I should think about this.
Yeah.
And I just started like writing down things that had happened to me and things that I'd, you know, and also, you know, because class is very unstable, you kind of think, you know, did they give that job to a middle-class person like over me because of class? Or is it just that they're better than me? And you have no idea. You don't know whether to complain.
No, you must end up with a lot of questions.
You've got no idea whether this is just your fantasy, your paranoia. You know, is this going on inside your head, or is there something real here? And so, and when you then start talking to other people about their experience, then that starts to become more real because you see it's happened over and over again.
There's a line in your piece that I've highlighted, which sort of speaks to what you were just saying then. You say you're talking about actually those sort of shoots of optimism, but you say we must continue to speak up and build infrastructures for working class protagonism. And I really liked that, and that sense in which those stories need to be told to build solidarity, but also, you know, it's that Nan Goldin, well, just to paraphrase it, you know, the more of us there are, the more of us there are. And to continue to build those connections and recognize that your experiences were real and valid and shared amongst your community. Because it is that sense in which, especially within spaces like the university, which thankfully I've escaped, although I'm sorry, Dave, that you're still kind of trapped within it. But that was exactly the kind of space within which, you know, yeah, that not knowing what other people's class experiences were and making very, very kind of hasty assumptions that your own experiences might be irrelevant or indeed problematic. You know, that's what keeps people silent. That's, you know, it enshrines silence within those spaces. So I just love that sense of working class protagonism. And I think we also need to bring that back into to also more forms of popular culture as well. And certainly, I mean, only in my kind of experience, but I felt like even in the 90s, you know, a decade which had significant, you know, there's lots to critique and indeed criticize sort of politically and culturally, but spaces like Channel 4 and like television and also like the bands who were, you know, able to be successful making music, like you just had much more scope and space to hear working class voices and experiences.
We ran out of time at this point, so a quick thank you to Lillian Wilkie, who's a writer, editor and publisher based in London and East Sussex, and to Dave Beach, who is an artist and reader in art and Marxism at the University of the Arts, London. And I'm Matt Hale, the host of this Art Monthly talk show. Thank you for listening.